19 years after the Oklahoma City bombing, unanswered questions resurfaced last week. A four-day trial in Utah sought to determine if the FBI has done an adequate search for additional videos of the 1995 bombing of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building. Salt Lake City Attorney Jesse Trenadue says he still believes there's a video showing Timothy McVeigh was not alone in detonating the bomb.
In trying to find out what happened to my brother, all the trails, all the leads kept taking me back to Oklahoma City. I did not know why early on, but now I do. It's the only thing that makes sense. Why so many people would have devoted so much time, money, and effort to fighting me over the death of my brother.
Today on Oklahoma Voices, we rebroadcast a 2007 documentary about the death of Kenneth Trenadue, produced by our former news director, Scott Gurian. That's all coming up after this hour's news. This is Oklahoma Voices on KGOU. I'm Brian Hartzinski. On Thursday, the trial in a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit concluded in Utah, brought by Salt Lake City Attorney Jesse Trenadue. He's convinced there's unseen footage of the Oklahoma City bombing showing two men exiting the yellow Ryder truck parked along Northwest 5th Street between Robinson and Harvey Avenues shortly before 9 a.m. on April 19, 1995. Trenadue says he believes the presence of a second suspect explains why his brother, who resembled a police sketch of a suspect, was flown to Oklahoma months after the bombing. His brother died in a federal holding cell. U.S. District Judge Clark Wadups didn't issue a ruling Thursday. Instead, he requested final court briefs summarizing arguments from both sides, and a final decision could be months away. Today on our program, we're going to look back at Jesse Trenadue's quest to learn about his brother's death in a 2007 documentary produced by KGOU. Here's the show's producer, our former news director, Scott Gurian.
Jesse and Kenneth Trenadue grew up poor in the 1950s in an Appalachian coal camp near Cucumber, West Virginia. Their father and grandfathers had all worked in the mines and developed black lung disease. But when coal prices fell during the Korean War, the Trenadue family packed their belongings in their car and headed west on Route 66, like the Okies, as Jesse put it. The two boys began a new life in Orange County, California. Jesse got a scholarship to the University of Southern California, where he was track and field teammates with O.J. Simpson. But Kenneth dropped out of high school, joined the Army, and became addicted to heroin. He wandered between various blue-collar jobs and eventually resorted to robbing banks. Jesse picks up the story from here.
He lived in San Diego and years ago had been convicted of bank robbery in San Diego. He'd gotten an argument with his probation officer and refused to report, and that was in 1987. And in the summer of 1995, he's arrested crossing the border from Mexico and sent to Oklahoma City to the Federal Transfer Center and was dead 2 days later.
Prison officials ruled the death a suicide, but Jesse Trenadue had his doubts. So he began searching for answers, but he encountered a series of roadblocks that he believes were attempts to cover up the actual circumstances surrounding his brother's death.
If he'd been killed by two or three prison guards, the FBI would have turned those men over in a heartbeat. There has to be a reason why all of the evidence disappeared. The logbooks that would have shown who had access to my brother disappeared. If they didn't disappear, the pages are missing. The crime scene photographs, negatives of crime scene photographs, disappeared. Out of the FBI file alone, some 41 pieces of evidence disappeared without explanation. It was the greatest case of disappearing evidence I've ever heard of, and there has to be a reason for that.
That reason, Jesse Trenadue contends, was first revealed in an anonymous phone call he received about a year and a half after his brother's death. Now, keep in mind that Kenneth Michael Trenadue died on August 21, 1995, just 4 months after the Oklahoma City bombing. The caller told Jesse that his brother was killed in a botched FBI interrogation and that authorities mistook his brother for a white supremacist bank robber who may have been involved in anti-government attacks like the bombing of the Murrah Building. Jesse Trenadue didn't make much of the call at the time, but then in 2001, he was contacted by an unlikely source.
Shortly before he was executed, I received a message from Timothy McVeigh, who said that when I saw your brother's picture and read how he died, I knew that the FBI had killed him because they thought he was Richard Lee Guthrie. Well, then I got a photograph of Guthrie, and Guthrie looks exactly like my brother. And Guthrie and my brother also matched the description of John Doe 2, which was being circulated by the FBI when my brother was picked up.
That's to say both were white males of similar age and height, with dark complexions, powerful upper body builds, and dragon tattoos on their left forearms. And they were both found driving mid-1980s Chevrolet pickups. Now, here's the kicker.
I don't think it's happenstance that my brother supposedly committed suicide by hanging himself when he's beaten head to toe, front to back, and his throat slashed. Guthrie supposedly killed himself by hanging himself while in federal custody. And the only witness I had to my brother's murder, another inmate, supposedly hanged himself a week before we were going to have a trial in my brother's case.
In the 12 years since Kenny's death, Jesse Trentadue has been in and out of federal court, using his skills as a lawyer to battle with the FBI and the U.S. Department of Justice for more information. He's hounded the media and lobbied members of Congress to get them to look into the case. He's met with Terry Nichols to find out more about the chain of events that led to the Oklahoma City bombing and how Kenny might have fit into the picture. He's even posted classified ads in newspapers and on bus shelters, offering rewards to anyone who comes forward with further details. The documents he's uncovered along the way have led him to ask much larger questions than those that he set out to ask.
In trying to find out what happened to my brother, all the trails, all the leads kept taking me back to Oklahoma City in the bombing. I did not know why early on, but now I do. It's the only thing that makes sense. Why so many people would have devoted so much time, money, and effort to fighting me over the death of my brother.
This is Oklahoma Voices. I'm Scott Gurian. If you ask most Oklahomans, the 1995 bombing of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building is pretty much an open and shut case. Timothy McVeigh was executed in 2001, and bombing co-conspirator Terry Nichols is serving a life sentence in Colorado. But Salt Lake City attorney Jesse Trentadue has raised questions about the official story, questions troubling even to some of those intimately familiar with the bombing, who would be quick to dismiss other conspiracy theories like the suggestion of a Middle East link. These questions were echoed by the veteran FBI official who was in charge of collecting evidence from the site of the Murrah Building. Former Deputy Assistant Director of the FBI Danny Coulson told the BBC there were very strong indicators that other people were involved with Timothy McVeigh but were never caught. He said that FBI headquarters prematurely shut down the agency's own investigation into alleged links between the bombing and a white supremacist community in eastern Oklahoma called Elohim City. And he's calling for a federal grand jury investigation to settle things once and for all. Other high-ranking FBI agents have disputed any talk of a cover-up, and a congressional report released late last year concluded that while some mysteries remain unsolved, there is no conclusive evidence of a wider conspiracy. We'll get a healthy dose of skepticism a bit later on today's program when author Lane Crothers, who's studied the militia movement, explains why he thinks it's entirely possible that Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols could have pulled off the entire bombing plot from start to finish without the knowledge or logistical support of a wider group of people. But first, for more about the Trentadue case, journalist James Ridgway joins us from a studio in Washington. His article, In Search of John Doe Number 2, the story the feds never told about the Oklahoma City bombing, appears in Mother Jones magazine. When I spoke to him recently, I asked him to begin by reviewing the circumstances surrounding the death of Kenneth Trentadue.
Well, Kenneth Trentadue was a former bank robber who had been arrested and put in jail and then allowed out on parole. And he got married to a woman in Mexico and he went back and forth. So, and then Kenneth Trentadue, for one reason or another, I guess had broken parole. And I think he was back in one time for a short period of time. And the parole people said, you know, you got to stop drinking. He drank a lot of beer. And he said, you know, something to the effect of screw off. And just went around his business, I guess, drinking beer and getting jobs. That was the situation when he was coming back from Mexico with a friend, I guess of his wife, in a car, and he was stopped at the border. It was very late at night, as I recall, and they thought he was drunk. So they ran a check on him, and they found he was a parole violator, and they arrested him, and they took him to prison, I think first to San Diego, then to L.A., and then he was sent to Oklahoma City to a big federal center there where they said they were going to hold a parole hearing. So he was there, and he called his family, and he sounded great, and they thought he'd be out pretty soon, you know, like in 6 months or something at the most. And that was the last. The next thing they heard was they got a call from the warden, the acting warden, a woman, who said that Kenneth Trenadue had died, that he'd committed suicide. And they asked the family how they could help. And, you know, the family was stunned, and especially his brother Jesse. He never thought of Kenny as wanting to kill himself. And he didn't sound like he wanted to kill himself when they last talked to him. I think the warden then said, well, maybe they could help him out because they could cremate the body. And Jesse said, no, he wanted to have an autopsy. He wanted the body back in West Virginia. So they sent the body back in a coffin, and they opened it up, and there was a lot of, you know, makeup on the face of Kenny and body of Kenny. But there were all these bruises, and it looked like he'd been beaten to death. So it didn't look like any suicide or anybody's idea of a suicide. So Jesse began a series of inquiries to try to figure out what had actually happened to Kenny. And this, you know, went on through the Bureau of Prisons and went on into the Justice Department, into the Inspector General of the Justice Department. There was a grand jury that was called. But there were no real crimes that were prosecuted out of all this. There was a suggestion by the government that certain people in the Bureau of Prisons might have not acted properly, but they weren't prosecuted.
And you, from your reporting, don't have any better sense of what may have happened that night?
Well, the sense that I get from what happened that night, which is all totally based on public documents, it's just highly unlikely the way they describe what happened in there that the guy committed suicide. I mean, it's just like if this guy was trying to commit suicide, he must have been like a clown in a circus. He kept trying, and he kept falling down and hitting his head against tables and sprawling across the room and bleeding all over the place. And the medical examiner in Oklahoma City said he didn't think it was a suicide. Other experts that they called in said they didn't think it was a suicide. Looked like he'd been killed. And that's the conclusion, or I don't know if it's a conclusion, but that's the impression I got.
Everything we've discussed up till now is pretty interesting on its own and certainly raises a lot of questions. But let's talk about how this case came to at least appear to be connected with the Oklahoma City bombing. I guess we didn't mention that all of this took place just a few months after the bombing in 1995.
Right. Well, what happened was that at one point he was sent some documents from the FBI. From an anonymous source. And these were documents that showed that they didn't mention Kenny, but they did show that the FBI and the government in general was investigating not just Nichols and McVeigh, but they were just investigating the possibility of an actual conspiracy before the Oklahoma City bombing. And that conspiracy centered around Elohim City, which is that, you know, religious community down in eastern Oklahoma, run by Reverend Millar, who is now deceased. And there was another group called the AARA Bombers, and that was the Aryan Republican Army. And those guys had conducted a string of bank robberies across the nation. They chalked up a record, I guess, that was equal to or greater than Jesse James. And they had a kind of MO. They'd go into a bank, and they'd be wearing masks, sometimes made in the form of the leading FBI agent in the town, or and they'd kind of act like a guerrilla gang or revolutionary gang, and they'd talk, you know, white supremacist stuff, and they'd leave like fake bombs, you know, when they took the money. But anyhow, there was some thinking in the government, in the FBI and elsewhere, that there might be a connection between these two. And there were certain people from both groups. There were by now, there are three groups. There's the Oklahoma bomb crowd, and then there's McVeigh and Nichols, and then there's the Elohim City people. And there's certainly a connection between the Elohim City people and the ARA bombs people, and there are suggestions that there was a connection, some kind of a connection, between McVeigh and this whole crowd. So when Jesse got these papers, these were internal, like, you know, teletypes, intels or whatever, he thought they were, you know, he thought they were pretty interesting. So he went to a federal judge in Salt Lake City, and he asked, he put in an FOIA request to get all the documents involving, you know, certain aspects of Oklahoma City bombing, thinking that maybe one of them would show something about Kenny. So he put this in, and the FBI came back and said they didn't exist. Well, since Jesse was holding these documents in his hand, he thought the FBI was, you know, running a number on him. So then he produced the documents, and the judge, you know, went ballistic, and he told the FBI to get the documents and make them, bring them, you know, give them to him, and they were made public. A lot of them were made public. So that led Jesse down this road of thinking that maybe his brother was, you know, mixed up. Maybe somebody got the idea that his brother, who had been a bank robber after all, and who did look sort of like John Doe number two, according to the drawing, and he also looked like this guy Guthrie, who was also suspected of being John Doe number two, that maybe there was some kind of like, you know, misconnection here, that people, they misidentified him. So he kept looking for that. And he's never really found anything. But the thing isn't over, because he doesn't actually know whether he's got the papers. He hasn't yet been able to depose some of the key people involved in the whole Oklahoma City bombing thing. For example, Terry Nichols, he's trying to depose him. But there are other things that make you wonder. For example, I mean, the government had like at least three informants inside the ARA, which is the bomb people, and Elohim City before the Oklahoma City bombing. And there were certainly reports from one of the informants, Carol Howe, you know, that's probably pretty well known out there, that they were planning to blow up a building, federal building in Oklahoma City. And there'd actually been a reconnaissance trip of some sort into Oklahoma City. And then it turned out that Reverend Millar, who ran the community, now see, he's dead. But his lawyer, Kirk Lyons, told me when I was talking to him that Reverend Millar used to trade information with the FBI. And he himself was an informant of sorts. He was trying to, you know, avoid a raid. Because everybody by that time, you know, everybody at that period figured that Elohim City was next in line after Waco. And if the Waco hadn't screwed up, that Elohim City would have been taken down. You know, and there had been surveillance over top of Elohim City. As I'm telling you, there were informants inside Elohim City. So that being the case, the idea that the FBI, the ATF, and all these other law enforcement agencies didn't know that these guys were talking about doing something. I mean, something, maybe whatever. They talked about bombing and blowing things up, and people passed it off as being just rhetoric. But they certainly were talking about it. And people from that community, a guy named Snell, had participated in an attempt in 1983 to blow up that building and failed. And he was going to be executed, actually, the night before the bombing. So there were all these things that, I mean, even if you didn't believe in conspiracies and didn't want anything to do with this, and thought it was a clean-cut deal between these two guys. I mean, it just cries out for a little bit more explanation. And that explanation didn't really come in the trial, either trials. As Jesse said to me one time, he said, you know, I started out trying to figure out who killed my brother, and I don't know. But maybe if I keep going, I'll figure out, you know, who blew up the building in Oklahoma City.
Speak about the political climate that existed after Kenneth Trentadue's death. I mean, this was the aftermath of what was the worst terrorist attack on American soil at the time, and this was also an election year. So I guess the Clinton administration was under quite a bit of pressure to find the perpetrators of the Oklahoma City bombing and close the case for good.
Absolutely. I mean, the whole thing is politically, you know, unfeasible. It's like a hot wire. Nobody would want to touch it in a million years. So that's why everybody, you know, who's ever looked at it just feels like, you know, well, they killed McVeigh and they got Nichols in jail for life, and maybe that's the best that's going to be done.
Where does Jesse Trentadue's case stand today?
Well, his major legal effort right now, as I understand it, is to widen the situation where he's got this FBI material. So what he's trying to do, he's trying to widen this out and figure out, well, what else comes to bear on that. So among other things, he wants to depose Nichols. And Nichols has sent him some letters and I guess given him an interview in which he suggests there were other people involved. Well, of course, it's in Nichols' interest to say something like that. So it's hard to know. But if he could get a chance to depose him and actually put, you know, file a paper in court, that might be interesting. That might be helpful. There are a variety. There's some prisoners, I guess, he wants to depose. But I think Nichols is a pretty key figure. And there's another guy, part of the ARA bomb group, named Langan, and he's in jail. And he conceivably could provide some information. He was sort of like the deputy commander. The chief guy, Guthrie, he killed himself. He hung himself. Now, no one's ever raised any questions about that. I mean, nobody suggested that he didn't hang himself. But he did hang himself under kind of mysterious situation where he was about to tell the Los Angeles Times, I think, or some other paper about what was really going on with the ARAs. So he hung himself before that happened. So I don't know. I mean, Jesse just kind of plugs along. In every move he makes, you know, he gets a little bit of something, and it adds to the, you know, adds to the, what do you call, stew, the pot.
You write that the government's refusal to disclose what it knew and what it did not know may also have forestalled the nation's best opportunity to address the problems in federal law enforcement and intelligence that would become tragically apparent on September 11th, 2001. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, the problem with the Oklahoma City thing is that there's all this secrecy about it. Like, what secret? Why should anybody be secret about this? It was a horrible crime. Why aren't the documents available? What's going on? I mean, what is this secret stuff? And the same thing happened with 9/11. It was discovered by a Senate investigating committee that the FBI handler, a key FBI agent in San Diego, was handling an informant in the Muslim community who had rented an apartment to two of the hijackers. And the FBI didn't bring this information forward, believe me. It was because of this, the investigators of the Senate committee that was ever discovered. And when these investigators, when that committee under former Senator Bob Graham tried to interview and get to testify the Muslim informant, the FBI basically hid him, took him away, gave him a lawyer. He never appeared. Very little mention of the guy's ever been made. I mean, he's been discussed in the newspapers to some extent. But there were these various, you know, warnings that the government got, not just the FBI, the CIA and elsewhere, that something was going to happen. You know, there was going to be an attack on the United States. I mean, there were warning after warning from, you know, intelligence agencies abroad. And yet, How come nobody did anything? How come there weren't any really explicit warnings here given to the public? It seems to me that the basic problem, aside from these horrid crimes, is that there's just this overwhelming blanket of so-called national security, which makes everything secret. And I just don't see the reason for this to be secret at all, the 9/11 stuff nor this Oklahoma City. So I don't know who they're covering for.
So in both these cases, even if they're not necessarily covering anything up, the FBI is losing credibility by being so secretive.
Well, see, the FBI loses credibility, but I don't think the FBI cares whether people think it's losing credibility. I mean, I served on a grand jury, a federal grand jury in Washington at one point. And when an FBI agent came in, to tell about some case, the guy who was going to be a defendant was as good as gone. I mean, the jury would listen in rapt awe to the FBI agent. And some of these FBI agents, of course, or a lot of them are really great, but some of them are ridiculous. So I think the FBI figures and law enforcement in general figures that they're strong enough and they can just do pretty much as they want, which is what they do, if you ask me. I mean, that's just my opinion,
I've spoken to reporters who've spent a lot of time looking at the various conspiracy theories surrounding the Oklahoma City bombing, and they've discredited most of those theories. But when it comes to Kenneth Trentadue, they say there may actually be something there. Is that your sense as well?
I don't know what theories they were discrediting, because the theories involving Ellicott City and perhaps the Kansas militia, they're fairly strong. But, I just don't know about Kenneth Trentadue. I'm inclined to think there's more to the case than we know about. And, of course, I think like everybody else's, I'm totally sympathetic to Jesse Trentadue. I mean, it's pretty incredible when a guy on his own, in Salt Lake City, he comes from West Virginia, he's real poor and everything, he's a lawyer, and on his own, he's fought this stuff against the federal government. And you just don't win against the federal government, Look at Sybil Edmonds, the woman who was a translator inside the FBI and who tried to blow the whistle on them right after 9/11 for their activities, various activities involving 9/11. Boy, she didn't get anywhere. They fired her. She tried to talk. They shut her up. The 9/11 Commission wouldn't listen to her. I mean, it's just really, really difficult when you have the united federal government in the various law enforcement and the court system against you. You have a really difficult time making your voice heard.
Do you think that Kenneth Trentadue will find out much more about this case, or do you think the FBI has pretty much released all that it's going to release?
I don't know. It seems to me that, you could have two things happen. One would be a true investigative, federal grand jury, which, is not so easy to pull off because most grand juries just do what the prosecutors tell them to do. Or you could have some kind of an independent counsel reopen the Oklahoma City case and investigate it. Somebody like this Fitzgerald guy, that might be quite productive. I think that would be the most productive route to go. It'd be wonderful to think that the Congress of the United States could pull off, put together and run an investigation like the Iran-Contra investigation, but I just don't see that happening myself. I could be wrong, but it seems that because, it's the Congress is so divisive and it's so locked in these various elections, I find it hard to believe they could put it together or would actually have the interest or the will to put it together.
Journalist James Ridgway's article, In Search of John Doe No. 2, The Story the Feds Never Told About the Oklahoma City Bombing, appears in Mother Jones magazine. We've put a link to it on our website, kgou.org. We should add that the FBI declined comment on this story, but in the past, it and the U.S. Department of Justice have denied allegations that Kenneth Trentadue was murdered or that they conspired to cover up anything. So, even if it could be proven that Timothy McVeigh was closely connected to Ellicott City and the gang of white supremacist bank robbers, and the FBI had informants in these groups and advanced knowledge of the plot to bomb the Murrah Building, why does Jesse Trentadue think nothing was done to stop it?
It's supposition on my part, but it's my opinion that the FBI had suffered such a black eye from what happened at Ruby Ridge and Waco that they need to restore their image. If you recall the criticism they were under at that time. So what they needed was to catch McVeigh and the others in the act with news crews and everything there to restore their image in the eyes of the American public. I think it got away from them. I think they knew the plan. And again, this is supposition on my part. McVeigh either knew about it and stepped up the date of the attack or did something different that threw them off.
Is it a likely scenario or just a wild-eyed conspiracy theory? We'll let you come to your own conclusions, but to help you in your efforts, we've posted on our website links to declassified FBI teletypes related to this case, reports from the Oklahoma Medical Examiner, statements from Terry Nichols, and other documents Jesse Trenadue has gathered in his quest to find out what happened to his brother. And we've linked to some photographs of what Kenneth Trenadue's body looked like after he died, though we should warn you that they're not for the faint of heart. It's all located at KGOU.org. So, sure, the circumstances surrounding the death of Kenneth Trenadue have caused some folks to ask new questions about the events of April 19th, 1995. But, of course, there are many people who are still convinced that it's pretty much a closed case. One of those people is Lane Crothers, professor of politics and government at Illinois State University and author of the book Rage on the Right, The American Militia Movement from Ruby Ridge to Homeland Security. A while back, I met him in his office a few hours south of Chicago and asked him to review with me the official government line on just who was responsible for the bombing of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building.
Their position has been quite consistent that, in effect, Timothy McVeigh was as close to this kind of lone wolf ideal as you can imagine, that he was an itinerant person who made transitory friendships with people, enlisted them to help him in small ways, or in the case of Terry Nichols, obviously more substantive ways, Michael Fortier as well, but for the most part had casual, brief relationships with lots of different groups on the right-wing fringe of American politics, but then in fact was not engaged in any systematic conspiracy with them, and so as a consequence that the principal actors in the destruction of the Murrah Building were in the end McVeigh and Nichols, and that they've got who they need to get.
I was going to ask about McVeigh's associations with various right-wing militia-type groups. How strong were those connections?
Well, that's, of course, the centerpiece of the conspiracy theories. The government's position, the prosecutor's position, has been that they've been relatively transitory and relatively, unserious, but inconsistent. And their argument is, if you look at his behavior, he lived about as solitary a life as a human being can live in contemporary America. He lived briefly in lots of different places. He didn't maintain long and abiding friendships with virtually anyone he met at any of these places. And so it seems to be more meetings of convenience and of similar mindset. But as soon as he found, for whatever reason, that the people in the place he was at didn't follow his ideas or just annoyed him or whatever it was, he got in his car and he drove and he went somewhere else. The conspiracy theorists, of course, want to allege that he built real networks, and most particularly in LOM City, that then became a centerpiece of the ultimate conspiracy.
Now, you've thoroughly studied the events and circumstances surrounding the Oklahoma City bombing. How convincing is it, in your opinion, that mainly two men, three if you count Michael Fortier, could have pulled off this whole plot from start to finish without the knowledge or logistical support of others, or would that have been totally possible?
I think not only was it totally possible, I think it's actually somewhat more likely. I think that a lot of the – and I must admit up front that I'm not a big conspiracy theory guy. I pay a lot of attention to them. I try to tease them out. But in the end, I find most of them fairly unsatisfactory. And I say that for two reasons. One, I think part of the insistence that there has to be a conspiracy is the shock that a simple person can do such a horrible thing. The evidence of history is that that's actually fairly common. But we want to believe in our hearts and our souls that these are demonic beings who you can identify from a distance and fix before they go wrong. And it's often not the case. The other reason is that the bigger you get a conspiracy, the more likely it is to be exposed. The simple fact of the matter is that most people want to tell their stories. Most people want to talk about how important they are. Most people want to share that secret information that pumps themselves up. And as a consequence, the bigger you get a conspiracy, the more likely it is that it's going to get exposed. That's why spy agencies work very hard to hire people, check up on them, and make sure, because they're constantly doing that kind of stuff to prevent that very kind of boasting and self-boosterism. In terms of the actual technical knowledge to do the truck bomb, lots of people can do that. I mean, aside from the fact that the information on how to do that is widely available in a number of public sources, it's not much more than a truck fertilizer and diesel fuel. I mean, it's just not that hard. And the basics of it are clearly outlined in the Turner Diaries, and it really pretty much explains how to do it right there. And if you've been in the military, as Timothy McVeigh had some familiarity with that, it's not in the least bit difficult for me to imagine. Doesn't mean there isn't a conspiracy. It just means that I actually believe that a smaller group of people is more likely to pull it off than a big group.
Now, Terry Nichols' attorneys, some journalists, and bombing victims have long suggested that McVeigh may have had some sort of help in the bombing from residents of Elohim City, this white separatist community in eastern Oklahoma. Speak about Elohim City, who lives there, what they believe, and how possible or likely it is that they may have been involved.
Well, I think Elohim City is one of those places that the mythology of is substantially more significant than their formal behavior. It's a place where like-minded racists and people who wanted to believe in the possibility of the overthrow of the government of the United States found a safe space. They were able to get together. The local community largely left them alone. A similar place would have been Hayden Lake, Idaho in the 80s and into the early 90s. They believe they're motivated from core Central American ideals. They believe that with a passion. They believe the rest of us have lost our way. And so as a consequence, they are acting out of a deep sense of being good Americans. How much of it was a training ground? They certainly allege that there were training grounds there for guerrilla war and for planning operations for bank robberies and other kinds of things. I don't doubt that there was a little bit of that. How meaningful that training is a very fair question. I mean, if you were the 101st Airborne Division, would you have been worried about the training at Elohim City? My guess is no, that in fact it's small arms fire and a little bit of military discipline and people who used to be corporals calling themselves colonels and believing themselves to be very important. And there's a lot of that in the right-wing militia movement. That said, it certainly was a place that lots of different people passed through, shared ideas, talked about their stories, talked about their complaints. I look at that more as a furnace of hate than of any kind of real place from which a war was going to be launched. That is, it's a place where people came and mutually reinforced their hate. It's a place where people came and mutually supported their fairly self-inflated, self-important visions of themselves. And then occasionally did things. The question of the bank robberies that came out of Elohim City, they surely happened. How systematic a threat to the real stability of the United States, I don't have a sense that it's as big as the subsequent mythology has made it.
The FBI has said that it investigated Elohim City after it discovered that McVeigh made a call there 2 weeks before the bombing. And the FBI, I guess, eventually ruled out that the residents there were suspects in the case. And it said it found no conclusive proof that McVeigh ever visited. But now Nichols has admitted to U.S. Congressman Dana Rohrabacher of California that he and McVeigh once drove past Elohim City. And McVeigh seemed to know all about it. He mentioned his friend Andreas Strauss-Meyer, who he called Andy the German, who lived there at Elohim City. And according to Rohrabacher's account of what Nichols told him, there was a strong indication that Tim McVeigh had more than just a minor association with some of the people at Elohim City. So if this was proven true, I mean, how significant would that be?
Well, there's two sides of the equation. Certainly, if McVeigh had an extended relationship with Elohim City, it would add fuel to many of the conspiracy theories that – remember, there's two basic conspiracy theories. One, right, that the government blew up Murrah Building. The other one, that the government knew it was going to be blown up but didn't want to expose their sources and therefore let it happen. It would certainly add fuel to the government cover-up story. As it happens, again, that's one of those stories where if you think about what Terry Nichols wants, and what Terry Nichols wants is to get out of jail. I understand that lots of people in Oklahoma are angry they didn't get the death penalty, but what Terry Nichols wants is to get out of jail. And so he's got to tease and present information that makes it likely that he can cut some kind of deal. As for whether or not that story actually means Timothy McVeigh has ever been to Elohim City, it doesn't follow that that's true at all. He might well have had a drunken conversation with somebody in a bar one night who told all this kind of stuff, and then in that kind of way that many people do, want to pump up and sound like they're in the know and sound like they have all this information, and so they make these casual references to things that they've in fact never experienced. And that's a not uncommon human reaction. So certainly if it's true, it adds fuel to the conspiracy theory fires, and I would hope there would be a really serious investigation into why it wasn't followed up better. I don't, however, think that Nichols' comment means that it's actually true.
I want to return for a moment to Andy, the German, Andreas Strauss-Meyer, who I guess was in charge of security there at Elohim City. What do we know about him?
Well, we know that he was German, that he came to the United States somewhat illegally. We know that the particular rumor is that he's John Doe number two. And many people will put the two drawings up of Strauss-Meyer and of John Doe number two. And there are at least some visual similarities. The people making that argument insist that Strauss-Meyer was the FBI contact in LOM City, and that therefore that's why the FBI didn't act when Timothy McVeigh rented, and that's why they haven't found John Doe number two, is because they are protecting their source. That's not the source that, in fact, the FBI and the source admits to as being the source inside LOM City. Strauss-Meyer then, of course, we know left the country immediately after the bombing, and so he no longer is in the United States. He's gone back to Germany.
What about the involvement of the Aryan Republican Army? I'm a little unclear. Were they the same as the Midwestern Bank Bandits, or those are two different groups?
To my knowledge, they're roughly the same group. I mean, obviously, you're right. You're going to have some intermixing of just some generalized thugs, and you're going to have some mixing of some other groups. But to my knowledge, most of those robberies were carried out by the Aryan group.
Let's speak about the string of bank robberies.
Well, yeah, there was just a series of bank robberies where this apparently white Aryan resistance group needed to raise money, involved themselves in a number of relatively petty bank robberies. My sense is that they were doing it to buy guns, which they believed in the long run would give them the resources to launch their war. As a practical matter, that goal was always silly. Doesn't mean the bank robberies weren't serious, and it doesn't mean that the people who were intimidated or scared in those environments weren't hurt. It just means that the 28 guys or however many it was in this group running bank robberies are not going to overthrow the government of the United States, no matter how many guns they buy. And so a lot of what goes on in that right-wing movement is very militaristic self-fantasy. They really do believe that the 1,000 guys acting like a militia are going to overthrow the government of the United States, just like we knocked off the British Empire. But of course, if you look at the history of the revolution, it wasn't the militia that beat the British Empire. It was regular armies. And so a lot of self-importance, a lot of self-inflation goes on in those groups. McVeigh is alleged to, by some conspiracies, to have participated in some of those robberies since he didn't have any money to buy all the fertilizer with, for example. The federal government says he got his money by robbing a gun dealer and stealing a bunch of guns and stealing a bunch of money from an unlicensed gun dealer.
It's Roger Moore.
Roger Moore, exactly right. Again, at this point in time, it's a question of whether or not you choose to believe the federal government. If you do, then the rest of the story is there were these other guys doing their thing and McVeigh was doing his thing. If you believe that there was more connection there, then there's some sense that the two of them might have known some of the other members.
I had interviewed Jesse Trentadue about his case, and basically he had received a message passed to him from Tim McVeigh shortly before Tim McVeigh's execution saying that authorities had mistook his brother, Kenneth Trentadue, for this guy, Richard Lee Guthrie. Richard Lee Guthrie apparently bore a resemblance to John Doe number two. I mean, maybe just because it was a very vague sketch.
I hate to break it to you, but so do you.
I'm sorry?
You look sort of like John Doe number two.
Do I really?
You're skinnier than he was, but...
Was it just a very vague sketch that anyone can look like him?
Well, I mean, it's dark hair, kind of, he was unshaven, but, you know, like a day's growth of beard or something, but a pretty thick beard, clearly darker than my skin anyway, but of course I'm, you know, sunburned through a window, nonetheless. So, yeah, basically, if you take a 5'8" man with dark hair, olive-ish skin, and a thick beard, you've got John Doe number two, who weighs 5'8" and 185 pounds. You got John Doe number two.
It's amazing. Everywhere I turn, someone else is claiming that someone looked like him.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's why eyewitness testimony is among the worst testimony in courts. And they regularly do these experiments where they, you know, have somebody walk through a room and then they ask people later to describe them, and you get 43 different versions of what the person looks like. He looks like a perfectly average person, and therefore he looks like everybody.
So this message Jesse Trinity had received apparently said that authorities mistook his brother for John Doe number two. And there was more than just the appearance. Apparently there was other things he was driving, the same kind of vehicle that authorities had put out a call for. He had a similar dragon tattoo on several things that he mentioned. And so his belief is that no one meant to kill his brother, but it was an interrogation that basically got out of hand. And led to his death. And then the real Richard Lee Guthrie strangely died in a similar way not too long afterwards. Just these little things keep very strange.
And indeed, I can't do it off the top of my head, but there was a time I could do off the top of my head the number of federal and Arkansas agents who had once been associated with Bill Clinton that people believe died in the aftermath of Waco or in Oklahoma City. I can absolutely do that for you. Now, does that mean there's no relationship there? I can't say that. I honestly can't. The question I look at is incentives. If you are an FBI agent and you got it wrong, and there is a John Doe number two, and that John Doe number two played a crucial role, are you going to go kill the guy? Or are you going to go prosecute him? Well, if you kill him, you might spend the rest of your life in prison. If you prosecute him, your career may be over, but you're going to write the book and you're going to sell the rights. And, I mean, it's just could it happen? Sure, it could happen. Absolutely. And we all know that prison is not the safest place in the world, and that whether deliberately or intentionally, a lot of people die. But, again, that's just – it just keeps you keep making the circle of the conspiracy bigger. Therefore, you keep making the likelihood of somebody talking about it bigger. And therefore, it seems to be more likely to break apart.
Right. This is very helpful. I'm glad I'm getting your responses to all these, because I'm getting so much from so many people. Okay. And I don't know what to believe myself.
They're all pseudo-credible. I mean, at some level, you can see the chain and how it fits together. And sometimes the government is just stupid. I mean, after Waco, there's clearly one of the two doors to the Branch Davidian compound. There were two main doors. It was a double door into the main compound. One of the two disappears. I mean, and it does. There's no question of it. Perhaps because it demonstrates that part of the story that the ATF wanted to tell wasn't true. We don't know, because we don't have the door. Right? But sometimes these guys, you know, they continue to shred at Arthur Anderson after Enron fell, right? I mean, there are sometimes stupid things going on and people try to cover them up. And once that happens, once that first mistake occurs, it becomes possible to weave together this very elaborate chain. I can spin you a different version of the same story. Let's assume for the sake of argument that when Timothy McVeigh called on April the 5th, 1995, and he called LM City and he wanted to meet, and at least the leadership claims they blew him off. Let's assume for the sake of argument that Andy Strassmeyer calls him back. They're roughly the same age. Maybe they've got similar interests. Maybe they want to go have dinner at McDonald's. And they chat. And Timothy McVeigh asks him to come to the Ryder rental place. And he says, sure, because it's a Tuesday night and there's nothing going on and they're rolling around. And so he's there for the Ryder rental, has no idea what's going on, is in no way, shape, or form connected. That's also a possibility. I don't know that it is exactly what happened. And so that's where the plane of credibility comes on. If you want to believe that Elohim City was important, that there must have been people at Elohim City who knew that Andy Strassmeyer was an insider, and that he knew what was going on when Timothy McVeigh went to the Ryder rental truck stop, then, yes, it's potentially a big embarrassment for the FBI on top of Waco, on top of Ruby Ridge. I mean, there's three really bad years for the FBI right there. There's no way past it. And that chain makes sense. On the other hand, if you just take a little bit out of that chain of credibility, you can tell an entirely different story that makes perfect sense as well.
You're saying that facts can be interpreted in many different ways. Even though they're facts, there still depends on what you make of them.
That's exactly right. And that's what every prosecutor knows, and I don't think most people understand, is that prosecutors tell a story with facts. But it's not necessarily the story, and they charge the people they think they can convict, not the people that they're not sure they can convict, which, of course, feeds the conspiracy theory, right? So it's very hard to – we would like to believe that the truth explains itself. As a practical human matter, it doesn't. And when you get into these deeply painful and deeply charged and horrifying situations, it seems to me only more likely that you're going to get conspiracy theories just like you get them after the 9/11 attacks or whatever else. People don't want to believe that 19 nasty people could do something like that. And obviously they had to have help, but nonetheless – and I think that's what you get a lot of with Oklahoma City, particularly since Terry Nichols didn't get the death penalty, and a lot of people want that kind of what they consider closure.
So, I mean, what kind of facts would you need to, if, you know, when you go about something like this to prove anyone was complicit in something? I mean,
well, there were people who refused to believe that Richard Nixon knew about the break-in until we finally found the tape. And we finally found a tape. It took a very long time that Nixon says, you know, how are the plans for the break-in? And they're like, oh, okay. But that was, you know, 25 years after the Watergate investigation. Even in the presence of a smoking gun, some people will refuse to believe you. But more often than not, it requires, for the deep, hard conspiracy theorists, it requires that kind of smoking gun, absolute evidence. You'd need to hear the tape. You'd need to see the video. You'd need to see a running transcript of every conversation in Elohim City for 10 years that Timothy McVeigh was ever involved in, and everybody going, Tim, we don't want to talk to you. Go away, for them to pull back from their position. For most citizens, I think they've accepted the general main story of the government. There's a basic trust that it may not be the entire story, but it's most of the story. That Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols and Michael Fortier and, you know, those three people were more or less responsible for why on April the 19th, 1995, the Murrah Building exploded.
Lane Crothers is professor of politics and government at Illinois State University and author of the book Rage on the Right, The American Militia Movement from Ruby Ridge to Homeland Security.
And you're listening to a 2007 episode of Oklahoma Voices we decided to rebroadcast today after last week's conclusion of a trial brought by Salt Lake City attorney Jesse Trenadu. It could be several weeks before U.S. District Judge Clark Wadups issues a ruling. The views and opinions expressed by our guests over the past hour are not necessarily those of the staff or the management of KGOU or the University of Oklahoma. We'd love to hear what you've thought of this program. Please send us your feedback to news@kgou.org. I'm Brian Hardzinski. On behalf of our former news director, Scott Gurian, who produced this program, thanks for listening to Oklahoma Voices on KGOU.